Also, the headlines, Russia and Ukraine say their air defenses have downed missiles and drones as the war enters the 20th month. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. South Korea and the U.S. have kicked off joint war games in the waters east of the Korean Peninsula amid simmering tensions with Pyongyang. South Korea's Navy says the three-day exercises involve 9 vessels and 2 patrol aircraft from the two sides. They will focus on anti-submarine warfare and live fire drills. Spokesman for the drills says the exercises will serve to effectively deter and respond to nuclear and missile threats from the Democratic Republic of Korea. The DPRK says its military moves are defensive and has condemned the joint war games as rehearsals for invasion. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hundreds of settlers, backed by the Israeli military, stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque, drawing condemnation from Muslim countries. The settlers toured the compound and performed rituals there, which are considered sacrilegious to the site. Saudi Arabia and Egypt have separately condemned the move, describing it as a provocative act. Saudi Arabia's foreign ministry said Riyadh firmly stands by the Palestinian people and supports all efforts to end the occupation. Egypt also called on influential international parties to fulfill their responsibility to protect Palestinian holy sites and the legitimate rights. Under decades-long agreements signed by Israel, non-Muslim worship at the Al-Aqsa Mosque is prohibited. The site, however, has seen almost daily incursions by Israeli settlers in recent weeks. Jamal Juma is a founder and coordinator at Stop the Wall Campaign, who joins us from occupied Ramallah. And also, Mukhaibar Abu Sada joins us. He's a professor of political science at Al-Azhar University, joining us from Gaza City. Welcome to you both. Jamal Juma, we know that this act happens on a frequent basis, but I believe that the frequency has been ramped up quite a bit. Are we looking at what are the goals that you think that this extreme cabinet has when it throws its weight behind the settlers, especially with its extreme minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who has also desecrated and went on this trip to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, supported by Israeli security forces? They want to Judaize, basically, Al-Quds, and they want this to become a norm?
Yes, of course. We are witnessing since years now this systematic escalation of attacks on Al-Masjid Al-Aqsa. And that's clearly come into a plan to take over Al-Aqsa Mosque, because they consider Al-Aqsa is one of the most important areas. They want to control total Jerusalem. And in the process of Judaization of Jerusalem, since they announced in 2002 about the greatest Jewish Jerusalem that takes 10% of the West Bank, the focus became on Al-Aqsa Mosque because it's the heart of this plan of Judaization of Al-Aqsa Mosque and Jerusalem in general. And nowadays, with this fascist government now and led by Smotrich and Netanyahu, what they are trying is to accelerate and to finalize this. Means that by all this very violent invasions that has been participated by all these officials, ministers, they want to make it like a de facto, the annexation, the dividing of Al-Aqsa Mosque, controlling who can get in or out, decreasing the number of the Palestinians and Muslims who can go to Al-Aqsa, and controlling who can go and who cannot. They were controlling outside Jerusalem, well, in the Palestinians in West Bank and Gaza, but now there are small restrictions even on Jerusalemites, on the people or Palestinian Muslims from 48 who's coming. So that's what they want. They want to have a total control on this place. Total control means total occupying, total sovereignty on the whole area, against the whole what we have been historically known from the Jordanians responsible over Al-Aqsa Mosque. So they consider their sovereignty there a sovereignty on Jerusalem. Without it, no full sovereignty on Jerusalem.
It was more than a month ago, I believe, but it was very recent, Mukhaibar Abu Sada. I don't know if you recall that there was a plan that was given by one of these extreme ministers of Israel to divide the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And basically looking at an excerpt of what divisions they had promoted, they wanted to give the southern part of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound to the Muslims, but the settlers would be getting the central and the northern parts, which would include the Dome of the Rock. And of course, Palestinians were outraged at that point. Along with that, they also made an announcement saying that they wanted to end Jordan's guardianship at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Tell us whether this plan is something that they want to enact at some point, and they are testing the grounds by the incursions that are being made right now.
This is the ultimate goal of the Israeli authorities, to divide Al-Aqsa Mosque, especially between Muslims and Jews. And if you look at the number of Israelis who storm Al-Aqsa Mosque on a daily basis, that leads to this conclusion. And let me tell you that up until this moment, today, more than 350 Israeli settlers and Israelis have stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque since the early hours of this morning. And many of these Israelis are performing rituals and Jewish prayers inside Al-Aqsa compound, which is in total contradiction of the status quo of Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is designated only for Muslim prayers. And Jews can only visit Al-Aqsa Mosque just like any other foreigners, but Israeli Jews do not respect their commitments and the status quo of the Al-Aqsa compound. It's true that many Israeli extremists are basically pushing the government and pushing the Israeli authorities to divide Al-Aqsa Mosque, especially like the same case which would happen with the home of the patriarch, the Al-Haram al-Ibrahimi, or the Mosque of Ibrahim, which had been divided between Jews and Muslims. And there are many days even Muslims and Palestinians are not allowed even to pray inside Al-Haram al-Ibrahimi in Hebron. Therefore, it seems to me that this is the beginning of the division of Al-Aqsa compound between Jews and Muslims. And the Israeli government, who has basically declared it official at the beginning of the formation of this government coalition, that this government is going into annexation of parts of the West Bank, I don't think that this government will hesitate to take further measures to try to divide Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that is taken by the rising number of Israelis who storm Al-Aqsa Mosque on a daily basis, especially those extremists led by Israeli Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and many other extremists who storm and perform Jewish rituals and prayers inside Al-Aqsa compound.
Thank you for that. Mukhaibar Abbasada, Professor of Political Science at Al-Azhar University. Jamal Jumma, thank you so much. Founder and coordinator at Stop the Wall Campaign on Occupied Ramallah. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Russia says that it shot down four Ukrainian drones over the northwestern part of the Black Sea and the Crimean Peninsula. Russia's defense ministry said four other drones were also destroyed overnight over its southwestern regions of Kursk and Belgorod. No information on possible damage or casualties is currently available. This is the latest in a series of Ukrainian drone attacks on Russian positions. Meanwhile, Ukraine's southern port of Odessa was hit by Russian missiles overnight. The attack destroyed grain stores. Ukraine's Air Force says it has intercepted 19 cruise missiles and drones during the attack. Western countries, especially the U.S., have supplied Ukraine with advanced and sophisticated weapons to fight Russia. This comes as Moscow has warned that arms deliveries to Kiev will only prolong the conflict. The Iranian president has categorically rejected accusations that the country's move to enrich uranium at the 60% purity level was aimed at building an atomic bomb. In an interview with CNN, Ebrahim Raisi said Tehran ramped up enrichment only after European countries, quote, trampled upon their commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal. He said if the European signatories return to the deal and fulfill their obligations at any time, Iran will undoubtedly comply with its commitments as it has done in the past. Elsewhere in his interview, the president said U.S.-mediated efforts to normalize Israeli relations with some Persian Gulf Arab states, including Saudi Arabia, will fail. This comes as Riyadh has reportedly informed Washington of its decision to suspend all negotiations on normalizing ties with Israel. There have been lots of speculations about the possibility of Israel and Saudi Arabia reconciling these days, from the Saudis abandoning talks with Israel to both Israel and Saudi Arabia sounding optimistic about a possible reconciliation. One viewpoint holds true across the spectrum. Any reconciliation with the Zionist regime is a stab in the back of Palestinians.
But I believe that we are at the cusp of an even more dramatic breakthrough, an historic peace between Israel and Saudi Arabia.
The Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu on Israel-Saudi normalization. And here he is again.
I think that under your leadership, Mr. President, we can forge a historic peace between Israel and Saudi Arabia.
The Saudi Crown Prince seems to echo the same sentiment.
Every day we get closer. It seems it's for the first time a real one, serious. We're going to see how it goes.
Two problems here. First, just days ago, it was said that Saudi Arabia had abandoned any normalization talks with Israel, which was reported widely. Yet when the Saudi Crown Prince was asked about it, he said,
"There were reports that you had suspended talks."
No, that's not true.
The Saudi Crown Prince, however, has said the issue of Palestine is of utmost importance.
For us, the Palestinian issue is very important. We need to solve that part.
Question is, how important? Is it a non-negotiable, or is it open for negotiations?
We have a good negotiation. Let's continue.
Now comes the Saudi foreign minister, who had this to say about it at the UNGA podium.
بما يكفل حق الشعب الفلسطيني في إقامة دولته المستقلة على حدود عام 1967 وعاصمتها القدس الشقيقة.
To paraphrase his statement, peace that allows Palestinian people to have an independent state with Al-Quds as its capital. If that's the case, Israel-Saudi reconciliation is a non-starter. There's no way that neither the Israeli Prime Minister nor his far-right extreme fascist cabinet would agree to it. So what is the deal? Why is Saudi Arabia wasting time talking to Israel? How can Netanyahu say that he cares about the Palestinian cause, yet say this about their position?
But I also believe that we must not give the Palestinians a veto over new peace treaties with Arab states.
And while talking about the importance of Palestinians, his forces murdering Palestinians. Just today, two shot in the head, bulldozing their homes and detaining them. Is Saudi Arabia serious that it may reconcile with this apartheid regime?
Tel Aviv and Washington have ratcheted up the push for the Saudi-Israel normalization as part of the so-called Abraham's Accord. So far, the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco have signed accords with Israel. There is widespread consensus that these countries have abandoned the Palestinian cause by signing this accord.
Credible nuclear threat.
The Israeli Prime Minister was up to his old antics at the UNGA podium, using his props to make a point, a red marker and a piece of cardboard.
Today I bring this marker to show a great blessing. The blessing of a new Middle East.
This new Middle East that he talks about, referred to by Iran as West Asia, has already happened. It's called the Iran-Saudi reconciliation. Further proof of that, Iran's foreign minister hooking up with the Saudi FM in New York on the sidelines of the UNGA, where there was talk about a comprehensive cooperation agreement with Riyadh. But there's no denying there is a conflict of interest when it comes to Saudi-Iran reconciliation versus a possible Saudi detente with Israel in more ways than one. The Iranian president had this to say about the possible normalization. And what about the U.S. and the U.S. President Joe Biden, whose hand the Saudi Crown Prince has rejected on more than one occasion? The U.S. has been more cautious than the upbeat assessment of Israel, saying things like a breakthrough is far away and steep obstacles remain. But perhaps a point overlooked by the media may provide a window into what the real intentions of the U.S. is. One of the reasons behind the U.S. enthusiasm behind denormalization, countering China's inroads in the Persian Gulf. This was a clear reference to China's Belt and Road Initiative, a stance supported by the Israeli Prime Minister.
That great promise in the G20 meeting that you participated and led, you spoke about an economic corridor that would link Asia, the Middle East, and Europe together. And such a corridor will make Israel a very important hub on a highway of unprecedented prosperity.
The U.S. and Israel, through the trade route, as shown here, want to stand up to China's One Belt, One Road initiative. And as the saying goes, kill two birds with one stone through this strategy. But will it work? Consider this. China is Saudi Arabia's number one oil customer. Saudi Arabia has just become a new BRICS member. Saudi Arabia has reconciled with Iran, with many PGCC Persian Gulf countries to have done the same or are in the process of doing that with Iran. That's called the New World Order. It would be wiser for Netanyahu to reconcile with his own people, who have protested for over 38 weeks, before aspiring to reconcile with Saudi Arabia.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Economic divide.
African countries are rising up to the colonizer France. One by one, they're realizing that they were taken advantage of. But how did France do that? Well, one of the ways was through what's called the CFA franc, the monetary note, which is nothing short than a country being pillaged. Hi, I'm Kavit Ahwe. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, some of the highlights, the CFA franc, the French way of controlling the monetary system in the countries being colonized, but it undermined democracy and the economy. However, it ensured French colonialism. Next, we take a look at France's agenda as another one of the highlights, in which African underdevelopment was one of the purposes of France vis-a-vis the respective countries. Also, forcing reliance on raw material exports. And another method was a monopoly on exports and imports, all to the advantage of France. And then the relationship between France and African leaders, complicit in choosing leaders, and also French and U.S. control was broken. How did that happen? You had the recent coups, which were a form of pushback. Africa is going through a political turmoil. Just weeks ago, Gabon witnessed a coup. It was the second former French colony in Africa to face a military coup in as many months.
and the sixth in 3 years, following Mali, Chad, Guinea, Burkina Faso, and most recently, Niger. Anti-French sentiment is running high across those nations. That is due to France's dark colonial past and its neo-colonial footprints there. One of those elements is the CFA franc zone, created by France in 1945. The CFA franc was meant to control the cost of access to raw materials from the colonies and to shield France's corner from the other monetary bloc controlled by the UK, the sterling area. CFA franc remains, to this day, the currency in place in 14 African countries. Regardless of their independence from France decades ago, the currency is controlled by the French Treasury. In practice, African countries channel more money to France than they receive in aid and have no sovereignty over their monetary policies. The currency is referred to as a tool of monetary servitude, the invisible tool of France-Afrique, or, in plain terms, the colonial currency. The pact between France and its former colonies was designed to ensure the deliberate underdevelopment of African nations at the expense of France.
It's time now for our media post for this program. First up, the pros and cons of the CFA franc zone. This article went on to say the main features of the franc zone are the fixed exchange rate, formerly with the French franc, now with the euro. It went on to say membership of the franc zone implies a sharing of sovereignty with France and with the other members of the monetary union. Next up, we took a look at this viewer comment on the matter, where said, by the name of Is It Real, said the $2 billion in assistance to Niger is actually a loan from the World Bank to be repaid with interest. France knows how to twist the truth to make it sound like welfare. France helping fight terrorists is just an excuse to keep French troops on the ground in Niger to secure their corporate interests. It is not in their best interest to actually drive out the terrorists. All right. Next, we go to a website. It asks how France continues to dominate its former colonies in Africa. It said, in France's former African colonies, imperialist monetary policies from Paris continue to cripple domestic economies and undermine democracy. Then it said colonialism in Africa won't have meaningfully come to an end until true economic sovereignty is allowed to flourish. And finally, we go to another viewer comment by the name of Lee to Lee. It said, Niger is not a state in America or Europe. It is in Africa. The people are very poor, while the country is very rich in natural resources. There is no electricity. The uranium generates electricity in France and Europe for their industries and families. They don't care about Niger. Get rid of them, Niger. They are like parasites draining your body from blood. All the troops must get out of Niger now. Ouch, that's pretty harsh when it comes to the role that France plays in Niger. All right, it's time for our first Q&A. Let me introduce our guest. We have Dr. Charles Sinkala. He is a senior researcher in governance for Member of Parliament and also a presidential candidate in the 2021 Zambian elections. Dr. Sinkala, welcome to Economic Divide. So taking a look at the CFA franc and the role that that has played, and of course the way that France executed this monetary system. You have the banks from Africa that deposited the money into the French treasury, and of course that's a large portion of the foreign currency, which they couldn't even use as collateral, amongst other things. Can you tell us more about what some have described to be the violation of a country's sovereignty when it comes to France and its use of the CFA franc in Central or in Western and Central Africa?
Thank you very much, and I think we must understand the basic of the background of the Francophone countries. The 14 old countries were purchased in the what we call the Berlin Conference in 1884 and 1885, what we call the auction of Africa, where France purchased these territories, and they have owned the territories in terms of the central banks. And they own, whatever minerals or whatever that income comes from those countries.
All right. Thank you for that. Let me introduce our next guest now, Kwame
Gunza joins us. Kwame Gunza is a director of operations at Connect Africa. Kwame Gunza, welcome to Economic Divide. The relationship between France and these African countries is really incredible. I mean, I'm looking at, for example, how it also involved, on purpose, keeping these countries underdeveloped. I'd like to find out from you if that's the case. And that would be obviously to France's advantage. For example, forcing reliance on raw material exports, and also how the French monopolized things like shipping, exports, and imports. And this system of the CFA franc was designed by France to ensure that French colonialism actually prevailed. If that's true, then why did these countries allow this to happen?
Yeah, so there was a combination of tools that France has used. When these countries emerged from independence, a lot of them were impoverished. And you remember they created the Bretton Woods institutions. And the Bretton Woods institutions were presented as institutions which were coming to help the reconstruction of the poor countries that were emerging out of colonialism. They used a combination of tools to be able to put back these countries to the place of subjugation, and that is the IMF and World Bank. If you look at Africa in the 1970s, Africa had a share of global manufacturing of up to 7%.
Time now for the Info News section of the program. First up, we took a look at U.S. poverty that has been in the news recently. The reason being that it has jumped for the year 2022 based on the records that came out. And what's alarming is that child poverty more than doubled, and that's the first increase in 13 years for that country. Some of the reasons: the expiration of pandemic programs, which are refundable tax credits and stimulus payments, were, I guess, a contributing factor in that case. Our take on that: the 2021 child tax credit expansion as part of President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan provided parents between $250 to $300 a month per child. Also in April 2023, the most recent month with available figures, 41.9 million people in 22.2 million households received SNAP benefits. SNAP is a program for people who can't who don't have enough money for food, basically, and they need assistance with food. And that translates to 12.5% of the total U.S. population. Unbelievable. All right, next up, we go from the U.S. over to Europe and the Eurozone in particular, where we took a look at the economy there. Eurozone money supply has shrunk, and this, for the first time in 13 years, signals economic downturn for that zone. Europe as a whole is sliding into a recession as the August PMI numbers all turned negative. So the Eurozone is not doing well. Europe as a whole, in terms of its respective countries, also not showing good signs and economic indicators. Next up, we went to a meeting by the name of G20, not by the name, a group of G20 that held this meeting over in New Delhi in India. There was a joint statement that was issued and included climate financing, global debt, the reform of institutions like the World Bank, and also a new Green Development Pact. No action plan, however, on global debt, the cost of living crisis, including inflation, and the world energy shortages. Obviously, we had to go in and put our analysis into this. The G20 started back in the year 1999 in the wake of the Asian financial crisis, meant as a forum for finance ministers and central bank governors to discuss global finance and economic issues. Now, fast forward to 2023, the global economy is besieged by soaring inflation, mounting debt, and is fueled by climate emergency. So we ask, what good is the G20 if they're the 20 top economies of the world and they're not solving problems that, in a sense, are repeating themselves year in and year out? All right, those were the news that we picked for every news section.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
In-depth section of the program. France's control of its colonies was not something that happened recently. It has been going on for quite some time, decades really, but its monetary control through the CFA franc showed the true colors of a colonizer. That is what we'll be looking at in this in-depth section. So let's get going. Well, it was the year 1800 in terms of the date where France forced an official exchange rate with the French currency. Paris sought to monopolize these circuits of production. Even French armed troops were sent to markets. They forced merchants to actually accept the French currency. And in turn, trade taxes were demanded in francs. So just one of the ways. Next, let's go and take a look at the countries that France had colonized. Obviously, we want to see what they were. It's broken up into West Africa and Central Africa. And some of the countries, Benin, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Chad, Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, Guinea-Bissau. We have the Ivory Coast, Mali, Niger, Senegal, Togo, and the Central African Republic. The count is 14 countries in all, and that happened during the date of 1930s, where those 14 countries came under the control of France in terms of colonizing it. Now, let's move on to the next one. Enforcing colonialism, how do they went about it? Well, in the 1930s onwards, France dominated the money supply. And these were some of the perks. For example, it used African labor and then access to raw materials at sub-market prices. Those were just now a couple of examples. And then what it would do, France would actually sell the finished goods that it used in those two examples back to Africa at above-market prices. And this is what's called Franc-Afrique there at the bottom. Yes, that's how France, as a colonizer, took advantage of Africa. Next up, let's go to the year 1945. You have the birth of the CFA franc. That's when that happened. It created those two currencies, the Central African CFA franc, and then that would be this banknote, for example, from Senegal. And then you had the other, which is the one from Congo. So these are the two different currencies that it actually created. In essence, it controlled the monetary sovereignty of 14 nations. These 14 nations made up nearly 200 million people. All right? Now, let's look at the way that they controlled these countries in terms of the money distribution. Now, member states deposited half of their exchange rate. It went to the French treasury. These are the exchange reserves. Additionally, you had another 20% that was deposited for financial liabilities, as it's called. This meant that member state had access only to 30% of their money. So obviously, that doesn't sound like a fair shake at all, especially when you have to deposit that much of your money and you don't have access to it. So that's another way that France exercised its CFA franc monopoly. When all that's said and done, France had a very cozy setup. It had 14 African countries set up to provide it with the raw materials, as we discovered, at rock-bottom prices. Manpower, low wages, to help it with its manufacturing. And then on top of all that, it had these countries deposit their money at a central bank, which then France turned around and generated revenues from that. You couldn't have a better setup than that. All right, let me now bring in Mahdi. He joins us to tell us what's coming up in his section. Mahdi, did we leave anything out from how France controlled its colonies?
Hi, Kavit. There are many other ways that France is making money off its former colonies, and these methods are short of stealing money, like what France does with the CFA franc money in the French treasury. I will cover that at length in the quick take section.
All right, thank you for that. We'll find out more from Mahdi, obviously, in his section. Now let me bring back our guest for our Q&A here. We have Dr. Charles Sincala, rejoining us, economic and senior researcher in governance for a Member of Parliament. Dr. Sincala, welcome back to Economic Divide. So I'm looking at France and how it used its relationships with these countries. of its former colonies, that is, but in the aspect of the leaders that were chosen to be in power, there was obviously a relationship that benefited both. But we're looking at how there are coups that have happened recently, one after another. Gabon, Niger, the Ivory Coast also. Now, the French grip appears to have been broken. I mean, why do you think these countries are rising up at this particular time?
Yes, Cameroon, Burkina Faso, Mali, Cameroon and Eritrea, most of those nations has been infested by coup d'etats. You know, what happens in the African continent, it's a short of money, the short of currency, the short of resources in terms of the currency that they have dominated, the United States of dollars. And, you know, governments are installed by those who have interest that the United States of America, France, Russia, they've got companies which have got the military complex where they contract their military mechanism. The part of the military budget, I think it is an average of $460 million a budget to guarantee them that they won't be coup d'etats. But these are the ones who actually perpetrate and install presidents.
All right, thank you for that. Let me bring back now Kwame Gonza, Director of Operations at Connect Africa, who rejoins us. Kwame Gonza, welcome back to Economic Divide. It's very interesting how we're looking at the respective countries recently, such as Niger, such as now Gabon, and then we're looking also at the Ivory Coast, where the governments there, the people basically don't want it, and you have a transition taking place, whether it's to a military transitional government or otherwise. But people have realized that the resources of the countries is not working to their benefit. France obviously had a relationship with the heads of state, which benefited both, but not the people. Give us your take as to why we're looking at things happening at the rate they are at this juncture in time.
Yeah, so I think the financial success is dependent on whether the government represents the current which takes over after the one which represents the neo-colonial interests or the colonial interests represents the people. So that is where that kind of success will come from, a government which cares for the people. We have seen that in places like Burkina Faso, for example. We have seen that in Niger and Mali so far. In Gabon, we are not sure. So these coups are not the same in many cases. When colonialism was abolished, various territories remained divided. And so they remained vulnerable to that manipulation from outside. And this is what our forefathers were trying to fight against when they talked about unification, so that we can be able to.
Across the France-Afrique spectrum, France still today controls the currency, foreign reserves, the comprador elites, and trade businesses. France de facto controls the overwhelming majority of infrastructure in Francophone Africa. It is a virtual monopoly. Multiple French giants are operating in Africa, like the French conglomerate Bolloré's control of port and marine transport throughout West Africa. Then there's Bouygues Vinci, which dominates construction and public works, water and electricity distribution. Total has huge stakes in oil and gas. And then there's France's big banking, Société Générale, Crédit Lyonnais, BNP Paribas, to name a few. France has for decades made sure that there's very little intra-Africa trade. There have been attempts by African leaders to get rid of French control. Back in 2019, it was announced that the West African currency would be reformed and replaced by an independent currency to be called ECO. However, ECO would still be pegged to the euro and the burden that it implies.
Non ha un'identità culturale precisa, non ha...
Neo-colonialism is on the move. Look at what the UK and Germany have done in Africa. But let me tell you, France has to be held accountable the most for what's happening in some African countries. Europe must act now to give back to Africa a prominent role.
The project is, however, yet to materialize. The growing unpopularity of France in Africa and the younger generation's rejection of its presence are no accidents. There cannot be a French-American solution to Africa's challenges.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Mattia Possian. We want to take a look at the other ways France makes money off its former colonies. One of the ways is through the exchange rate from the CFA franc to the euros. Initially, the CFA franc was pegged to its French counterpart at a rate of 1.7 to 1, but in 1948 it was increased to 2 to 1 by overvaluing the CFA franc. Paris maintained its economic advantage while crushing Africa's export competitiveness. The transfer of the money to the French treasury is another way that the French government makes money off its colonies. Not only can they not use this money as collateral, sometimes they have to pay the French central bank just for keeping it there. We know that the CFA franc denominations are in euros, but when accounts are in credit, the African central banks effectively place their foreign exchange reserves at France's disposal. But when the central bank's accounts are in debit, they are obligated to pay interest to the French treasury. In other words, CFA member states pay France to hold on to their money. There is then the question of what France does with the money that is deposited in the French treasury. There are two very realistic things that France can do with that money: pay off a portion of its debt or invest that money at a profit. The total amount deposited by the CFA zone treasuries is around 15 billion euros. That's half of their foreign currency reserves, and it is refundable. With interest rates around 1%, they could produce about 150 million euros at most. There are speculations that this figure could be a lot more. According to this entry by a German newspaper, Africa pays 400 billion euros per year to France, which said the French government collects from its former colonies each year 440 billion euros of taxes. Finally, the exploitation of Africa by France wouldn't be complete if it didn't include two important sectors: natural resources, and then the one not that well known, and that is West African ports. It is no secret how African countries are rich in natural resources like uranium, gold, and oil and gas. Niger provides around 20% of France's uranium needs. Meanwhile, Gabon is a source of crude oil. Mauritania delivers iron ore, while Togo and Benin provide agricultural commodities. And now comes the icing on the cake. French national Vince Bulvard owns most of West Africa's major ports. It is no surprise, then, that former French president Jacques Chirac had this to say about Africa: "We have to be honest and acknowledge that a big part of the money in our banks comes precisely from the exploitation of the African continent. Without Africa, France will slide down into the rank of a third world power." That brings us to the end of this Quick Take.
Mali, Niger, Gabon, Burkina Faso, the countries continue to topple the Western Aligned governments, opting for new rulers, which, after the transition period, well, they're going to elect a leader that's going to work for the people, hopefully, using the natural resources of their respective countries. Now, former French colonies have realized alignment with France did not bring them what they deserved. After all, they truly need to get beyond what means of livings they have now, at a minimum. We'll find out if that happens. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for tuning in to our program. If you have any questions, any comments, we truly appreciate it if you send it to us. From Mikove Tapwe and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi and you're listening to the program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this episode, we're going to talk about the concept of humanity in the Holy Quran and the goal that Quran offers for a perfect human being. This is very important. Different ideologies, they define different ideals for I don't know, the best possible society, the best possible man, the best possible. So we should see what's the best possible man according to the Holy Quran and what are the elements that make that being possible. And we can understand that through understanding the perfection that Quran has for mankind. We talked about this and we said that with this discussion comes a distinction between two lives, the life of this world and the life of the hereafter, and how Quran compares the two with each other. It is very important to understand that the life of this world is like the beginning step of preparation for that perfection. This is where we can fulfill our possibilities with the actions that we do. This journey is a journey that starts with the human free will, and this life is the only place that we have to exercise that free will in whatever that we wish. And it has consequences in our eternal destination and our eternal being. Quran talks about this life sometimes in the context of comparison with the Hayatul Akhira. We said that in other scriptures of other religions, the emphasis on hereafter is not like the Holy Quran in the eschatology, in comparative religious studies. And the part that is called eschatology, this discussion is brought up, and there are different elements that makes the treatment of Quran, of this topic, unique and different. One of them is the overall picture that Quran presents of Hayat al-Dunya and Hayat al-Akhira, the life here and the hereafter, makes it clear that as if the reality is the hereafter. For example, in one verse, Quran says, whatever that you have in this world, وَالْآخِرَةُ خَيْرٌ وَأَبْقَى, in the hereafter, it's better and most enduring. For example, in this world, you experienced, some sort of pleasure, for example. Or I don't know, relationships that you had, or the experience of time, the experience of different things. In the hereafter, these experiences are better and more enduring. It's the same thing, but way different. So, for example, the experience of time, the way that Quran makes the contrast between this world and the hereafter and shows that the hereafter is the real reality. It says, for example, on the Day of Judgment, some people start a conversation about how long they had a life, how long they stayed in dunya. And Quran says, إِذْ يَقُولْ أَمْثَلُهُمْ تَرِيغَةً. The best of the answers to this question from them is by those who say, we only lived in dunya for one day. So you see, that life is so real that long life here, like 7 years, looks like one day only. So this is the way that the comparison is made in the Holy Quran. We go for a break, we come back with more examples of such comparison in the Holy Quran.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hussein Latifi. You're listening to the program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the comparisons that Quran make between this life and the life of hereafter. And we said that the Holy Quran gives a picture. In that picture, the life of hereafter is the true life. And the true perfection of man happens there. For example, Quran says the life of this dunya is mata'un ghalil, is a small thing in comparison to the hereafter. Or for example, like as I said, the example of the experience of time, this example we have it in our hadith as well, that it's like a dream. And when you wake up, when you have a dream, well, it's not that it is nothing. It is some experience that you have. It could be a nightmare. It could be a happy dream. You feel pain. You feel happiness. It's true. All of these true. But then at the end of the day, it's a dream. You wake up. And when you wake up, you realize that it was not that serious. When you wake up, you realize it was just a dream. It was like an hour. Maybe you experienced it in the dream. It took so long for you. But when you wake up, you realize that it was just a dream. And now it's finished. So the same thing is true with the Day of Judgment. When people wake up, there is a hadith that says, "Anna sunyam idha matu intabu." People are asleep or are dreaming. And it is only when they die, they wake up. So when they wake up, it's not that they didn't suffer in life or they didn't feel happy in life. No, all these emotions, all these feelings they had and they went through. But at the end of the day, it was just a dream. It's compared to the reality that they face there, the dream is nothing. It gets more serious when the dream has some a real consequence. Imagine that you had a dream, for example, and it was a nightmare last night. And then when you wake up in the morning, they tell you, because you were patient in the dream that you had last night, we're going to give you a great thing like a house or a car, for example. How happy you are, because you say, okay, it was just a dream and I reacted well, and then this is the reward. So the same is true with the situation of Hayat al-Dunya and Akhirah. It's like a dream. The feelings, the emotions are true. They are there. Nobody says you don't feel happy. Nobody says you don't feel sad. Nobody says you have a bad life. No, you have a bad life. It might be a nightmare. But the secret of the thing is that if you react well, and if you're patient, if you pass this test correctly, then you're going to have eternal consequences. You're going to have eternal reward, which is unmatched with the transient and short period of time that you went through some of those difficulties and everything. So when people see the reality of the hereafter, they remember dunya as a very short and a small thing. This is very important in the description of the dunya in the Holy Quran, and something that we should keep in mind as well. Thank you very much for listening. Inshallah, in the next episode, we talk about another element in the perfection of humanity according to the teachings of the Holy Quran. Have a good time. Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen. Sallallahu ala Muhammad, sallallahu ala Nabi, sallallahu ala Muhammad, wa ala Nabi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Thank you.
The headlines. The U.S. and South Korea hold joint military drills in the waters east of the Korean Peninsula amid escalating tensions with North Korea. Hundreds of settlers backed by the Israeli military once again stormed out.